Well, wild wanderers, we've just passed the spring equinox, the official start to spring. It's the time of year when many animals are mating and having babies, and likewise, in many cultures, it's celebrated as a time of rebirth and renewal. And one of the animals heavily associated with this time of year is rabbits. I mean, they are known for their reproductive frequency, and at least one is rumored to hide brightly colored eggs in baskets of goodies. So as we head into springtime, let's take a closer look at the order Lagomorpha, rabbits, hares, and one you may be less familiar with, pikas. I'm your host, Tim the Nature Nerd O'Hara, and this is the Dispatches from the Forest podcast. Lagomorphs are widespread around the world and inhabit every continent except Antarctica. But that said, they're not found in the most southern cone of South America, the West Indies, Indonesia, or Madagascar, or on a lot of islands. They're also not native to Australia, but they have been introduced there, and, as is often the case when a species is introduced to a non-native habitat, they've made themselves into a nuisance and caused problems for many native species. But I digress. Now, before I get into the individual lagomorphs, pika, rabbits, and hares, I want to talk about some of the traits that all lagomorphs share. So first, let's look at how lagomorphs are different from other mammals. While they look similar to rodents, and they are related to rodents, there are some key differences between rodents and lagomorphs. Rodents are characterized by two large incisors in their upper jaw. Think mice, squirrels, and beaver. Lagomorphs have four incisors in the upper jaw, two large incisors and two smaller incisors called peg teeth, behind, not next to, the front incisors. While in rodents the incisors grow continuously, in lagomorphs all their teeth are what's called open-rooted and grow continuously, which is why both rodents and lagomorphs need to gnaw constantly, usually on high-fiber foods, to keep their teeth from growing too long. Lagomorphs tend to be more strictly herbivorous than many rodents. Most rodents are omnivores. Another major difference between lagomorphs and other animals is that they don't have paw pads. Toe pads maybe, but not paw pads. Instead, the bottoms of their feet are entirely covered in dense fur. Interestingly, the only non-lagomorph that also has this trait is the red panda. All right, now I need to talk about poop. I'm sorry. Now, at some point, you may have heard that rabbits eat their own poop to get more nutrition out of it, and while it looks that way on the surface, it's not exactly true. Lagomorphs engage in what's called cecotrophy. So what is cecotrophy, you ask? Well, I'm about to tell you. Cecotrophy is an adaptation for a diet that's high in fiber and low in nutritional value. This is a problem, and cecotrophy is just one way to handle it. Other herbivores deal with this problem in different ways. For example, ruminants like cows chew the cud to process their food a second time and extract more nutrients. Horses have a very long colon, which aids in digestion and absorption of nutrients. But both these strategies add significant bulk to the animal. Clearly, cows and horses, much bigger than rabbits and hares. Lagomorphs are on the bottom of the food chain. They need to stay light and nimble to escape from predators. Cecotrophy lets lagomorphs get more nutrients out of their food without the added bulk. Now, like other herbivores, easily digestible food is processed in the intestinal tract and expelled as feces. These are the pellets you see on the ground. And to be clear, lagomorphs don't eat these pellets. Okay, maybe once in a while, but not regularly. These pellets tend to be hard because they have little moisture and very little odor. Harder to digest fiber, on the other hand, makes two passes through the GI tract. The first time through, small particles of fiber are moved into the cecum, which is where the small intestine and the colon meet. There, they're fermented by microbes into something called a cecotrope, which is not a turd, but a nutritional package. Cecotropes are a group of small balls clumped together. They look sort of like a thin blackberry. They're very dark, almost black in color. They're smelly, look wet, and they're sticky because they're covered in mucus. They're also very soft and full of nutrition. Psychotropes are usually eaten as they're expelled. They rarely touch the ground because, well, that's just gross. They're swallowed whole, not chewed, so that the mucus doesn't get disturbed. After re-ingestion, the psychotropes continue to ferment for another 3 to 6 hours before moving to the small intestine, where the nutrients can now be absorbed. The whole process takes about 17 hours. Now, the GI tract of newborn rabbits is sterile and contains no microbes. The babies eat psychotropes and regular feces from their mother to get the microbes they need for their own cecum. Young rabbits start eating their own psychotropes at about day 20. So there you go, everything you never wanted to know about psychotrophy. Make sure to bring it up at the next dinner party you attend. I guarantee you'll be a hit.
Becoming popular by talking about psychotrophy at dinner parties cannot be guaranteed. Rules and restrictions apply. Side effects may include a reduction in invites to future dinner parties, social distancing, and having people whisper about you and call you weird behind your back. Talk about psychotrophy responsibly.
Okay, now let's talk about the individual lagomorphs, starting with the least well-known by most people anyways, pikas. There are 34 species of pikas worldwide. 2 are native to mountainous regions of Western North America, and the other 32 to Central Asia. They average about 6 inches long, are brownish-gray in color, with rounded ears and no noticeable tail. They kind of look like a cross between a hamster and a guinea pig. Some species of pika live in scree, making their home in the crevices between broken rocks, while others dig burrows in upland areas. The rock-dwelling species are typically long-lived and solitary. They usually have 1 or 2 small litters a year, which keeps their population relatively stable. Burrowing species, on the other hand, are short-lived, gregarious, and have multiple large litters during the year. These species tend to have large swings in their population size. Now, there's only one pika species that lives in the lower 48 states, the aptly, if unimaginably, named American pika. American pikas are intermediate in size for pikas, 6.5 to 8.5 inches long. Like other lagomorphs, they have densely furred soles on their feet, except for black pads at the ends of the toes. American pikas live in the mountainous regions of Western North America, from central British Columbia and Alberta and Canada, south through the Rocky Mountains to New Mexico. They generally reside in scree or boulder fields fringed by suitable vegetation near or above the tree line. Pikas require cool, moist microhabitats on high peaks or watercourses. They're diurnal, foraging during the day, and they're intolerant of high temperatures. In the northern part of their range, they can be found at sea level, but in the south, they generally aren't found below 8,000 feet, about 2,500 meters in elevation. On a side note, pikas in the Himalayas can be found at elevations of up to 20,000 feet. The American pika, like all lagomorphs, is a generalist herbivore and feeds on a variety of green plants. They can get all the water they need from the plants they eat, although they will drink fresh water if it's available. But pikas are unique in another way. They have 2 ways of foraging. The first way, for lack of a better term, is the normal way. They go out, they find food, and they eat it. Pretty straightforward. And this method is used year-round. But in the summer, pikas also engage in what is called haying, where they gather food and cache it in a hay pile. You see, pika don't hibernate, so those hay piles are the food that gets them through the high-altitude winter. When haying, the pika will make 13 trips an hour, over 100 trips a day gathering food. But there's more to haying than just gathering and caching food. Here's where it gets really interesting. The timing of haying seems to correlate to the amount of precipitation from the previous winter. In years following a winter with lower snow accumulation and an earlier spring, pika start and stop haying earlier. And when haying, pikas harvest plants in a deliberate sequence. They seem to assess the nutritional value of the available food and harvest accordingly, choosing plants with the best calorie, protein, lipid, and water content. Forbs and tall grasses tend to be hayed more than directly eaten. And then, of course, we come back to the psychotropes, which, unlike other lagomorphs, pika might also store for later. Now, pikas establish a home range, the size of which depends on landscape features and the distance to and quality of vegetation. But this territory is generally less than 0.2 acres, and the pika only defends about half of that territory from intruders, so territories usually have some overlap. Actual aggressive encounters are rare, and they usually occur between members of the same sex. Territorial behavior increases during haying. Adult pikas of the opposite sex with adjacent territories will form mated pairs, although if more than one male is available, the female chooses which one she wants to mate with. Pikas are reflex ovulators, meaning the female ovulates after mating. Females have about 2 litters per year, averaging 3 kits each. Breeding takes place about a month before the snow melts, and the gestation period is about 4 weeks. Pika kits are born blind and slightly haired, but with fully erupted teeth. They open their eyes at about 9 days old. Mothers forage most of the day, but return to the nest every 2 hours to nurse the young. Young become independent after 4 weeks, but may stay in or at least near their mother's home range, although they stay as far away from their relatives as possible. Competition for territory may force them to disperse further. Pikas are vocal little critters, using both calls and songs to communicate among themselves. A call is used to warn when a predator is lurking nearby. Songs are used during the breeding season by males and in the autumn by both males and females. Now, studies suggested that some populations of pika are declining due to various factors, most notably warming temperatures due to climate change. Since they live at high altitudes and therefore cooler mountain regions, they're very sensitive to high temperatures. Pikas can die in as little as 6 hours when exposed to temperatures above 78 degrees Fahrenheit, that's 25.5 degrees Celsius, if they can't find shelter from the heat. This makes them one of the best early warning systems for detecting climate change-driven warming in the western United States. A study in the North Cascades National Park in Washington State found that a single winter of little to no snow caused drastic declines in pika abundance. And in fact, temperature increases are suspected to be one of the causes of American pikas moving higher in elevation, searching for suitable habitat and cooler temperatures. But American pikas can't just pick up and move easily in response to climate change. Their habitat is restricted to small, disconnected habitat islands in numerous mountain ranges. Still, the pika is not considered to be endangered yet. Okay, let's move on to the other lagomorphs, rabbits and hares. There are 42 species of rabbits and 33 species of hare worldwide. But rabbits and hares are very similar, at least more similar to each other than they are to pikas. Now, I don't think I need to describe a rabbit or a hare in detail to you. Big back feet, short round tail, long ears. If you want to get into the subtle differences between them, hares are generally bigger than rabbits, with longer ears and feet relative to their body size, and black markings on their fur. And for the record, a jackrabbit is actually a hare. Collectively, rabbits and hares form the scientific family of Leporidae. Pikas, same order, different family. Leporidae is Latin for those that resemble lepus, with lepus referring to hares, so it's those that resemble hares. While they are different, genetically they have different numbers of chromosomes, for simplicity's sake and because they're so similar, I'm mostly going to lump them together here, but I'll also highlight some of the differences. Now, not that you can see it, but interestingly, leporids have what's called a kinetic skull. A suture between regions in the skull remains open, forming what's essentially a joint in their skull. This joint allows the front and back of the brain case to move relative to each other, and it's thought that this helps absorb the force of impact as the animal strikes the ground when running. Because speed and agility are the leporid's main defense against predators. The five species of jackrabbits, which again are actually hares, not rabbits, found in Central and Western North America, can run 40 miles an hour, or 65 kilometers an hour, over longer distances, and can cover up to 10 feet, or 3 meters, in a single bound. Cottontail rabbits can run about 18 miles an hour in a zigzag pattern, but in a straight line, they can hit 30 miles an hour. A predator can't eat you if it can't catch you. Large hind leg bones and well-developed musculature make this possible. They also run on their toes. The hind feet have four long toes which are webbed to keep them from spreading when hopping. But for any good escape plan to work, it helps to know that your enemy's coming. The placement of a rabbit's eyes gives them a nearly 360-degree field of vision. They have just a small blind spot near the bridge of the nose. And rabbits sleep with their eyes open so that any sudden movements in their field of vision will alert them to danger, a trait not entirely uncommon in prey animals. And, as I'm sure you can guess, those big ears also make it easier to hear predators. But it turns out that rabbits and hares use their ears for more than just listening. It's well accepted that their ears help them maintain their body temperature, particularly in warmer climates. Leporids in temperate regions tend to have smaller ears to reduce heat loss, while those in hotter climates tend to have ears with larger surface areas, which helps keep them cool. So, hearing and body temperature. Is there anything else their ears can do? Why, yes. Yes, there is. It's theorized that in hares, the ears act as shock absorbers to help stabilize their vision when fleeing a predator. And that's not all. The ear muscles also help maintain balance when running fast and making tight turns. You ever see a video of a cheetah running and making a tight turn? You know how their tail makes big circles to help them turn and keep their balance? Well, it's kind of like that, but with ears. Now, random fun fact, rabbits are obligate nose breathers. I won't go into all the specifics, but the structure of the oral and nasal cavities makes it impossible for them to breathe through their mouths. Also, like rodents, lagomorphs can't vomit. And while we think of rabbits as quiet little animals, they actually use quite a few sounds to communicate, including soft vocalizations or thumping the ground with their foot to warn others of predators. And the sound a rabbit makes in distress is, well, kind of horrifying. This sound is actually used as a form of bait to attract predators like coyotes, and you can buy wounded rabbit calls on Amazon. Now, some rabbits are solitary, but others live in groups. Most species live in burrows, and these species are often colonial, feeding together in small groups. A group of burrows is called a warren. Some rabbit species, like the cottontails, have nests above ground, usually under a bush called forms. Now, if rabbits are known for something other than their big ears, it's a high reproductive rate, and this reputation is well-deserved. For the record, female rabbits are called does, and males are called bucks. The average doe becomes sexually mature at just 3 to 8 months old and can conceive at any time of the year for the duration of her life, a lifespan that averages 2 to 9 years in the wild. Gestation is about a month, and the doe can get pregnant again as soon as the day after she gives birth. Baby rabbits are called kits, and a single litter can range from 4 to 12 kits, which, if you do the math, means that a single female can have up to 60 new kits every year. Kits are born naked and with their eyes and ears closed. The doe is aware that she gives off a scent which can attract predators, so she stays away from the nest to avoid putting the kits in danger, returning to the nest only a few times a day to nurse. Now, another fun fact, both rabbits and hares have two uteruses. But despite many physical similarities, the reproduction of hares is a little bit different from that of rabbits. Hares have a specific breeding season, which varies with latitude, location, and yearly events like weather conditions and new vegetation. And in snowshoe hares, the phase of their population cycle, something I'll talk about in a minute. Gestation period for hare is 5 to 6 weeks, and if you thought getting pregnant the day after giving birth was impressive, some species, like the snowshoe hare, can conceive a second litter as soon as the 35th day of gestation, thanks to that second uterus. So they can get pregnant while still pregnant. Now, often during the mating season, hares of both sexes can be seen boxing, standing on their hind legs and hitting each other rapidly with their front paws. Sometimes it's two bucks competing for access to a doe, and sometimes it's a doe trying to prevent a buck from mating with her. You know, maybe because she's still pregnant. This behavior is the origin of the English idiom, mad as a March hare. Litter sizes average 3 to 5, and does have 3 to 4 litters per year. Baby hares are called leverets, and unlike rabbits, are born precocial, which, if you've listened before, you might recall means that they are fully furred, open-eyed, and mobile, and for a very good reason. Since they're born in an above-ground nest, not a burrow, they're more vulnerable to predators. They usually leave the form within 24 hours of birth, and siblings might stay near each other during the day, gathering once each evening to nurse. At 4 weeks old, they're weaned and independent. Now, here in North America, northern populations of snowshoe hares have a population cycle that ranges from 7 to 17 years between peaks. Southern populations don't fluctuate as much. The period of abundance generally lasts 2 to 5 years, followed by a population decline when snowshoe hares can become locally scarce. Although there is some synchronization, not all areas experience peaks at the same time. Interestingly, Canada lynx, whose diet ranges anywhere from 35 to 97% snowshoe hare, depending on the season and hare abundance, also have a population cycle that lags slightly behind that of the hare. During a hare drought, lynx will move to areas that have more hares, sometimes covering over 600 miles, and during this time they tend to not have kittens. Then, when the number of hares increases again, the lynx population increases too. And with that, we bring this week's episode to a close. Thanks for listening. Be sure to leave a like and subscribe to the podcast. Feel free to leave me a comment if you have one. It is, as always, 100% free. If you enjoy the podcast, spread the word. Tell a friend, tell a coworker, tell a stranger on the street. If you want to support the podcast, check out our Patreon page and consider becoming a patron. Subscriptions start at the low, low price of just $5 a month, and after 3 months, you can get some cool merchandise. You can find all the information at patreon.com/dispatchesfromtheforest. If you'd like to make a one-time donation, you can do it through PayPal. dispatchesfromtheforest@gmail.com is my PayPal address and a great way to reach me with any questions, comments, or suggestions for future episodes. What do you want to learn about? Let me know. Go browse our merch store at cafepress.com/dispatchesfromtheforest. There's a lot of stuff there. I'm sure you'll find something you can't live without. For additional content, check out Dispatches from the Forest on Instagram, Facebook, TikTok, and YouTube. I'm your host, Tim the Nature Nerd O'Hara, reminding you to go outside and get dirty. The Dispatches from the Forest podcast is a production of Dispatches from the Forest and may not be used or rebroadcast, whole or in part, without express written permission.
What's up, Doc? There's a wabbit down there, and I'm trying to catch him. What do you mean, wabbit? Wabbits, wabbits. You know, with big, long ears.
Oh, like these?
Yeah, and a little white fluffy tail.
Like this?
Yep. And he hops around and around.
Oh, like this?
You know, I believe this fella is a R-A-B-B-I-T. Pardon me, but you know, you look just like a wabbit.
Come here. Listen, Doc. Now, don't spread this around. But, confidentially, I am a wabbit!